So you just in end of last year you finished a tour, the main European festivals and also in the US. In retrospect, what's your, I think, your key memory, your key souvenir from this tour?
Well, the key memory in general were very enthusiastic fans, of course. That was very obvious from the first moment when we entered stage that people were really waiting for this for a very, very long time.
Mm-hmm.
Second thing I recall, and that was also very positive impression, the band on stage was a band. It was not a project or anything. Of course, the friendship of me and John, they, you know, it speaks a long language, and so it does with most of the other people who worked on with on stage. But you cannot plan something like this. It, you know, musically and organically just happens, and that has been the case throughout the whole tour. So we had a blast in performing together, and we had really nice days in between. So it was a very nice summer in general. And then I have to say the most outstanding show and the most important show for us, of course, had been Wacken in Germany, because we co-headlined that festival. It was a very big production we have had there, really on a major band level, and the reaction and response of the people was overwhelming. We filmed that show, so we have a chance to do a DVD with it, and yeah, we had a blast over the whole summer.
One way or the other, was it, I suppose it was already, the project was already in progress, but was it an extra spark for the fact to work on this third chapter?
Well, I mean, the tour situation we faced in the summer interfered a little bit with our original plans. Our original plan was really doing an album and then going on tour afterwards for a little while. Of course, Demons and Wizards is second priority when it comes to a band like Iced Earth or Blind Guardian.
Mm-hmm.
So there always is only a limited amount of time for us to spend on this one. And the idea has been, you know, just basically composing songs, then doing the album, then being on the road, which was somehow, this plan was spoiled when we got the offer for the Wacken Festival to headline.
Sure.
And many other promoters just realized that Demons and Wizards would be ready to go for our next album. So a lot of other promoters tried their luck as well and invited us to, you know, similar festivals than Wacken.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to take that opportunity, even though we knew that we would not be able to release an album prior to these show appearances. So with regard to that, this was not exactly what we were planning, but with an opportunity given, you know, like this, we didn't have another choice. And our strategy had technically been to bring back the name of Demons and Wizards prior to the third album, because mm-hmm. Touched by the Crimson King, as we both know, is 15 years ago in the making.
Yes.
So there is a chance that people have forgotten about us. And with these live activities, we of course brought the name back.
Okay, so yeah, the tour was kind of a launchpad for this third chapter to write.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, just as you mentioned, when in 2005 with John you put the final touch on Touched by the Crimson King, could you think or imagine that the third chapter would need like 15 years to come?
We did not think about that, not at all. We considered Demons and Wizards to be an established band at that moment. Both albums have been very successful, and our idea was to come back with a third album as fast as possible. But due to many reasons, the time frames of Iced Earth and Blind Guardian completely collided mm-hmm. from that moment on. So we never had the opportunity to really join forces again. We started seriously talking about that album in 2010, and This Tells You a Story. So it basically took almost 10 years for us to find a spot like this to, you know, keep our focus on songwriting and then doing a production like we did. And still, it was on a very tough time schedule, and we, you know, I'm just happy how things turned out, but it was a struggle.
Okay. Also, in parallel, a few months ago, you released the remastered version of the two albums. So you had to, because you and John provided extra liner notes and the feedback and the environment from that period. Was it of any interest for you to dive back to this period, like 15 years ago?
Is that
an interesting or fun work to do, to kind of work on remastered and new liner notes?
I really rediscovered the stuff, and even more than I, John did rediscover the stuff. He had a partly wrong impression about Touched by the Crimson King, for example, so it was a very valuable activity. But the reason we did it was simply that our contract with SBV was terminated some years before, so the albums were not available any longer. And when dealing for the Third Themes Wizards album, we got these two albums in our luggage, and they are certainly too good, you know, to be just stored there and to be not available. So, of course, we brought these two albums into the contract, and reboot, you know, the interest on these albums, it of course was a very good opportunity for us to deal with technical improvements and a remastering, for sure. That's a bit of a difference when, you know, you listen to stuff nowadays, because the old stuff was done under the rules of the old days. Nowadays there are certain different demands, such as streaming, so it was a very necessary step for us to do so. And from what I've been told, the record company is very satisfied with the sales of these two albums.
Yes, but did you kind of discuss an exchange with Chris Harris, who performed the remastering work, or he worked on his side and then he proposed and then you said yes, or you tweaky, or you ask him to go one with this direction or the other? What's the process?
I mean, we of course know what he's able to do, and John even worked with him on a production level and spoke about him in very high terms. But yes, we discussed the stuff. What we basically said is, of course, the original intention and the original spirit shall not be destroyed by mastering, for sure. Mm-hmm. But we need to compete with nowadays masterings. And since he worked on so many projects, he gave us examples of what would be possible to do. And then we were able to make our choice in which direction we would like the stuff to be treated. And as mentioned, that is one of the big challenges for a band when, you know, re-releasing stuff, because since we have streaming as a very important tool of listening, you know, by the fan, that needs to be taken under consideration. And the way you treat stuff technically is different from a CD or from vinyl, very different, because you really go for the highest limits and sure, try to have the loudest output possible to be able to compete with other products, nowadays products, because once in a playlist and when your song comes and it's mastered old-fashioned style, then the volume will appear far quieter and people would have to use the volume knob to, you know, somehow saturate that, but they will not, and therefore you have to, you know, make sure that the measurement is in balance with the other actual products, and this is what Chris Harris did.
Yes, but we all know, and it's a great quality that you and John are perfectionists. You want to reach the top for each of your work. Is that not kind of dangerous, or try to restrain yourself to kind of, and you have to face that also with Vanguardian albums, to kind of each 10 or 15 years with new technology try to remaster all your work all the time? Where you put the limit?
I wouldn't go that far. I mean, if there comes new habits by the people, like, for instance, the streaming thing, you do not have a choice, and then you have to go back. You still should be able to make available what was your first intention. That is always very important. But I don't think that necessarily there has to be a fix up all, you know, whatever, 10 years. That's not necessary. Sometimes, like we did with Blind Guardian, you just want to rediscover stuff, and then you might, you know, do a remixing or you know, anything like that. And that sometimes helps to put a different spotlight on the whole work you have accomplished years back, but it is not totally important necessity, never. Okay. I mean, the most important thing is the creation of new music. As said, with Demons Wizards, we had the streaming issues on one side, and on the other side, the new contract, and a sort of re-release, which was necessary because the stuff was not available. Therefore, we did it. And the situation with regard to Blind Guardian was almost similar. We didn't have vinyl available for our back program when we did a new contract with Nuclear Blast for this old material also. And therefore, we went back and adjusted stuff and revisited it just, you know, for the sake of giving a little bit of quality to it. It's not so much a question of perfection at that point. The perfection lies more in the moment of the creation, I have to say.
Okay. If we come back to this, so three, if I understood that the way the process you work with John is that he's working on music, and I suppose you're exchanging files, he's sending you some of his songs or the tracks, and then you think about it, you kind of work lyrics, and then you exchange. Am I right? Is that the process?
No, that's not right. Because, I mean, the vocals are a very important part of music, and I do the vocal melodies. So what John is doing, he provides me with the instrumental arrangements or, you know, fragments of an arrangement that really depends on the song and what the status of the creation is. And then I do my vocal melodies to it first and all the vocal layers. And then we exchange ideas of if both things go together very well, then we continue, finish a song in terms of, you know, exchanging ideas like mentioned. And once we consider a song to be accomplished, then we start talking about the lyrics. And in many cases, since I'm doing the vocal melodies, I'm also doing the lyrics. But on all of the albums, there were like two, sometimes three songs where John did the lyrics for.
Okay. On the songs you can find on the album, was there one song which was really easy to finish, to put the final touch, and one song which was maybe very difficult and you had to work and rework and put it back on the table, or it was a pretty smooth process?
It was a very smooth process. It has to, because we don't have a lot of time and we both know what we are doing and we more or less know blindly what we expect from the other. So that is not the case. Of course, since there are always many options to sing melody lines over an arrangement, I come up with more than just one suggestion for a verse, for example. And then we have to basically decide which verse would fit best, or if we take all three verses and have three melodically different verses. Stuff like this needs to be discussed. There wasn't the easiest song to answer that question for me to accomplish was Midas Disease. That was quite obvious to me what to do there and how to arrange the stuff, so that went very quickly. And then there is other stuff like Dark Side of a Majesty, where the process of creation had taken a little longer from my side, but that was also related to the fact that John had quite different different understanding of the song and a quite precise imaginations of what he was expecting in the verse. And mm-hmm. There we exchanged ideas back and forth.
Okay. Okay, so you, on the final album you have 11 songs. Did you write more and then you make a selection, or you only finalize these 11 songs?
We only finished these 11 songs. The idea for this album, when making, was to come up with an album which probably has a length of 45 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
But the compositions we have had were 60 minutes long. But when finishing the album, all these 11 songs, we felt that they all were more or less on the same level in terms of quality. And therefore, we decided to use all the 11 songs because they are very diverse. And there is no filler. And since there is no filler, there was no need for us to hold anything back.
Do you still need to provide bonus songs from Japan, for example? Or is there any bonus on the Japanese version?
No. When we do songwriting,
yes,
there is a way of pre-producing stuff already.
Mm-hmm.
So what we have is more or less at least one proper demo version mm-hmm. when we finish the songwriting period already. And the record company can use that for bonus tracks as you supposed.
Okay.
But for Japan, it's not like in the old days that you reserve a particular song for them. That's not the case, at least for the last 10 to 15 years, I would say.
Okay.
But what a record company is also requiring nowadays, because of the many options they have in creating physical product, usually is an instrumental version, so
mm-hmm.
they can have, you know, one limited edition version
sure.
where this stuff is also presented.
Okay. The question might be stupid, but did you kind of brainstorm a long time to reach the title 3, or you had some options and you decided 3 is the best way to summarize the third chapter?
We always like the numeration thing. The first album is just called Demons and Wizards or Demons and Wizards 1.
Yes.
So the exception, to a certain extent, had been Touched by the Crimson King, where we for a long time also intended to call that number 2. So 3 is more in the natural progress of Demons and Wizards than
okay.
Touched by the Crimson King was. We just spoke about that in a very small moment when we did pre-production together in March last year. And I did not pay attention to a title anymore, and neither did John. So when the time for the album artwork came and the finalization of the booklet and all that stuff, we just confirmed that we still think that 3 is a very nice name. It's a very mystical number anyway.
Sure,
I mean,
sure,
that's lucky coincidence, but, you know, it's one of the holiest numbers when it comes to Christian religion and, you know, in many mythologic topics. It's a very strong number. So that fitted very well. And another coincidence, if you want to call it coincidence, in Diabolik,
mm-hmm.
we're dealing with the unification of Lucifer, Satan, and Beelzebub. Call that an unholy trinity, but we have the 3 there as well.
Good. You mentioned the artwork for the album. How did you work? Did you have a precise idea, or you and John, what you wanted, and then you described precisely to the artist what you wanted, or?
Well, when we did Diabolik musically, at one point we just decided that this is the perfect song to be the opener of the album because it's such a strong musical statement. And the working title, when John was doing the instrumental arrangements, was Diabolik. So the way I treated my vocal lines, you know, was also inspired by this. So they had also a menacing aspect. And there is that ethereal ending part, you know, where I do falsetto stuff. And that also is, you know, somehow reflected in the intro part of the song when the choir, you know, takes their pieces of music. And that all was so ethereal that it, of course, reminded us atmospherically and by the title Diabolik on our song Heaven Denies, which was mm-hmm. about the fall of Lucifer. So what we decided in first case was to do a sequence to that. And as mentioned, we described the events happening after the fall of Lucifer here. And we had several ideas how to create that story with regard to heaven to be a dystopian place and stuff like this. And at the next step, we were intending, since this was such a strong statement, to make that a video as well, which was conceptually created by me and John in the same direction, so that this would fit together. And these two outputs, they were, you know, finally the reflection we wanted to be seen on the album artwork. So John instructed his artists to go into that direction as well. You know, the two fallen angels you see in front of the door or gate of Lucifer mm-hmm. Are represented by John and me as well to round up the whole thing.
All right. You mentioned so the video clip, the Diabolik. In general, for you, to shoot video clips, it's fun or it's kind of necessary pain? Especially this time where you had makeup, green screens, and so on. How was it?
It was fun when doing, but usually it's a very necessary pain, which I try to avoid as much as I can. I'm really not the guy who wants to do videos. Most of the musicians I know are not into that. I mean, it's like a photo shooting. You don't want to do that. I basically, you know, hate all that stuff, and I'm, you know, I'm available and I'm doing it because I know it's very important nowadays with all the multimedia channels you are having. People, you know, really appreciate having something visual, and so do the record companies, and I understand the need for it, but it's nothing which I do with full fun. It was, you know, because the team, the Serbian guys who worked on it, they are very motivating, and they are, you know, they know how to get what they need to make it a good video, so that makes the process fun, but no, I would not like to do it. If there was a choice, I would avoid it.
And just my final question, because it will be time. Don't you find, you have a lot of experience, obviously, in the music business. Don't you find that weird that a long time ago, it was really necessary for video clips to be able to be seen in MTV at Beckham's Ball and so on. After that, there was a period where it seems video clips were not very useful tool anymore. And now, with YouTube and so on, it becomes again a very important promo tool. Don't you find that kind of cycle weird?
It is a weird cycle, but at least from my point, it has been a misunderstanding. When we did Beyond the Red Mirror with Blind Guardian, I was exactly the same opinion what you just mentioned. There is no need for a video clip, so I was not really pushing for it. But in the end, you feel that one tool to promote your album is missing. So it was always a good ingredients to make, you know, album cycle complete. And this time with Blind Guardian Twilight Orchestra and with Demons and Wizards, I was happy to take that opportunity. That's the opposite side. It's really a needful thing to have, and it was just the very short a period of adjustment, you know, where the TV station became less important or completely unimportant, if you want to say so, and something else took over. And I misinterpreted that as well with Blind Guardian, but there was always an importance for video clips. But on the other hand, you know, you see like live DVDs, visual live DVDs, yes. They, you know, nowadays appear to be very unimportant because people are obviously not tending to buy these DVDs anymore, so there is hardly any need for that. But once the internet streaming services become even more efficient, I'm pretty sure that this will become a topic again just because of that, and then, you know, the cycle will be completed again, and we have to do video DVDs to, you know, please the YouTube watcher or whoever, you know, whatever streaming service then is necessary to make that the biggest success.
Okay, makes sense. Once again, thank you very much for this interview. It was an honor and a pleasure to talk to you.
And I enjoyed it.
And wish you the best for the future. Take care.
Same to you, and I hope to talk to you again. Bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.